and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the role of nonprofit, social justice, and activism. With me, your host, Ethan Clow, and we are broadcasting, as always, on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on your radio dial, as well as streaming online live at citr.ca, and of course, via the podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, hello everybody, welcome to the show. This is episode 39 of The Sector, and it's Friday, March 27th. Well, it's been about 2 weeks since the last episode of The Sector. Well, the last new episode of The Sector, that is. We took a bit of a break after the CITR fund drive a couple weeks ago, just to sort of recharge and prepare for the next week's big show. That was, of course, episode 38. But unfortunately, after that week break, I actually got really sick. And you can probably tell by the sound of my voice, still not 100% over it, a little bit congested, a little bit throat's a bit tender and all that. But don't worry, I should be able to make it through this episode. And I really couldn't deprive people of The Sector for 3 weeks in a row. That would be just cruel. So we're back with episode 39. And lots to discuss on today's show, including some interesting political news. I'm sure people have already heard about some of the more controversial elements that are going down right now for Canada politically. You know, talking about it from a social justice, from a progressive political viewpoint, where are we going right now in our country in terms of the political machinations of Stephen Harper and the Conservatives? What are the Liberals and NDP up to? How is that all going to factor together? And ultimately, what is that going to tell us about the future of doing good in this country? So we're going to dive into some political issues a bit later on in the show. Additionally, I would want to give a quick thank you to everyone who did donate over CITR's fund drive. We're hoping to have the donor list, people who specifically mentioned The Sector as one of the reasons they were donating, hopefully in a couple days, probably for next week's show. But if not, I mean, who knows? I may get an email even now as we're recording. So we'll see when that comes up. And again, you know, a big thank you to not just people who donated to my show or Radio Free Thinker, but to the station as a whole. Of course, the goal was to raise $40,000, and we exceeded that. We raised $42,167. That's just amazing, and I'm so proud to be part of that process. That money is going to go help to create a new website, to digitize our old records, as well as all of the old historical documents that CITR has accumulated over the years, decades of operating as a station. And it's also going to help to finance our big move to the new Student Union building, which I guess is coming up in a couple of months. I know that it's been sort of slated to happen for the last couple of weeks, but you know what? Once we're there, it's going to be awesome. I really look forward to broadcasting there. And hopefully, if you're at UBC or in Vancouver, you can come by, take a look, because I've seen the blueprints. It's awesome. Well, we have a fantastic show coming up here on The Sector. For the next hour, we're going to be discussing a bit about politics here in Canada and the effect that it's having on the social justice arenas. Now, you may have heard of the Bill C-2, the Respect for Communities Act, which is being tabled by Stephen Harper's Conservatives. Basically, it is a really cruel bill that is designed to ban the establishment of new supervised injection facilities like Vancouver's Insight, and in addition, like many of the other proposed safe injection sites suggested for cities like Montreal, Ottawa, and around the world. It's become a popular and well-researched way to combat drug addiction and the spread of bloodborne contagions amongst the population. Places like Amsterdam, Portugal, Spain are all investigating this. So this new bill designed to cut this off is not just shocking in its scope, but ultimately potentially endangering to society. So we're going to examine that a bit later in the show. There's also another story about the Harper government's new family tax credit. Now, the CBC recently reported that the moral scope of this tax credit has actually really hurt a number of Canadians, particularly excluding single parents from receiving these tax benefits. And the reasoning behind it is to sort of moralize from on high down on what is a legitimate family here in Canada. Again, so we're going to examine that, talk about that. And of course, you know, we invite your feedback and your thoughts, and you can share them with us on Facebook and Twitter, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, as well as on Twitter. You can share them with me at Ethan Clow and with the sector at Sector Podcast. We're also going to discuss a few, well, I guess some better news, because I don't like to weigh this down with a bunch of negative talk. So we got a bit of good news for people who use Windows as an operating platform. So we'll discuss that after the break, as well as some interesting news from Gen Con, a popular gaming convention, and they're taking a moral stand. So we'll talk about that a bit later as well. We'll take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll return after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, of course, on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Now, question for you, listening audience, are you a Windows user? And if you are, have you made the shift from the old version of Windows to the new version of Windows? Because according to the statistics, most of you haven't, actually. About 55% of people who operating a desktop operating system are using Windows 7. About 19% are actually using Windows XP, which, you know, that's pretty old by computer standards. Only about 10% are using the most up-to-date version of Windows 8.1. And there's about 3%, I guess, of strange people who are using base Windows 8. And then the rest of it is, you know, Mac and Windows Vista and Linux, and but nobody cares about those things. The big question is, you know, are you using the most up-to-date version of Windows? And the reason I ask is because Microsoft has announced that Windows 10 is arriving very soon. Yes, you heard me, Windows 10. They've actually skipped over Windows 9, and they're going right for the good one this time, Windows 10. I guess you could say that Windows sort of has the same kind of operating philosophy as Star Trek films. The even odd thing, you know, one is good, one is bad. Well, we'll see how that turns out. But of course, the interesting thing about this is that, you know, Windows 8 is really not that old. You know, compared to the distance they got out of Windows XP, and obviously you're still getting out of Windows XP, Windows 8 is, you know, still pretty young. So the idea of shifting to a whole new operating system, a lot of people kind of went, huh, that's a little bit strange. But what's interesting, of course, is that Microsoft has announced that the upgrade to Windows 10 will be free. Yes, free. So what does that mean? You know, that's a really interesting way of looking at things. This has been the cash cow of the internet world for so long, now Windows is going to be free. Now, you might say, well, that's cool, I guess, but I'm sure it's only for people who are using Windows 8 or 8.1. Ah, not true. In fact, if you are using Windows 7, which I guess the vast majority of people are, you can still upgrade to Windows 10 for free. Now, you might say, well, that's great, but, you know, here's the thing, Ethan. I didn't really pay for my copy of Windows. Well, don't worry. Microsoft has you covered. Windows 10 will be a free upgrade even for pirated versions. So, that's a bit surprising, or maybe it's not, actually. Maybe Microsoft has actually caught on to, I think, what HBO has known for a long time, piracy is actually good for business. Given the fact that a lot of people on the internet, especially in countries where Microsoft doesn't have a great foothold, Russia, China, and elsewhere. Now, this is interesting news because it's a step in a different direction for some of these big companies. You know, previously you'd hear about lawsuits where they'd be suing users en masse for downloading pirated copies. And you get these copyright battles happening all the time. So why is this significant? Why am I talking about this? Well, I think it's interesting to point out that this is an example of a way that a for-profit company can adapt some ideas of doing some social good and still making a profit. You know, it's kind of blending a little bit of an idea from sort of the social enterprise sector. Now, granted, you know, Microsoft is doing this because they can convert a whole mess of people in China and elsewhere into paying customers who are going to be using things like Microsoft Office and subscriptions and apps and whatnot. But, you know, as we've talked about before, making money is not inherently evil. It's the question of how you go about making money. And by helping people adapt, move forward, and acknowledging the fact that, look, piracy exists, we now live in a post-pirate economy, let's take that and go with it instead of trying to claw back, kicking and screaming. So I think it's an actual kind of a hopeful and optimistic sign of the future that we're now recognizing the state of the world and we're trying to find ways to, you know, progress. And that's pretty cool. So we'll keep our eye on this and we'll see how this turns out for Windows users. And maybe when, you know, Windows 10 finally goes live, we can do a live report from Windows 10. And we'll get somebody who has a pirated copy to tell us about the experience. Alrighty, well, some good news then here on the sector. Let us shift gears and focus our conversation on something else. So, I mentioned earlier in the show the popular gaming convention Gen Con and how they are taking a moral stand. So first, if you don't know what Gen Con is, it is one of the largest conventions, primarily in the United States, focusing on tabletop gaming like RPGs, Dungeons and Dragons, miniature wargaming, live-action role-playing, collectible card games, strategy games, computer games, PC gaming, and all that kind of stuff. It's a great time if you're into that sort of nerd culture stuff. I haven't actually attended it before, but it's one of the biggest. In fact, last year, attendance was 56,614, which is pretty darn impressive. Gen Con was established in 68 by Dungeons & Dragons creator Gary Gygax, and it went on to be amazingly successful. It occasionally changed ownership over the years. Recently, it was owned by Hasbro, but then was sold to a new CEO. And actually, a little bit of a nerd fact, actually spent a short time under bankruptcy after they were sued by Lucasfilms. But nevertheless, Gen Con is, you know, a big convention still, big popular, very well loved by its fans. Now, they decided to take a moral stand. And you might ask, well, what is this moral stand and why? Well, since 2003, Gen Con has been hosted by Indianapolis. And its attendance has grown exponentially in that time. In 2003, it drew 25,000. In 2014, 56,000. So a pretty big impact on the local economy, as well as the impact, obviously, for the convention center, for bringing in foreign tourist dollars into Indiana. So it's a pretty big deal. This isn't like chump change or anything like that. Now, listeners may also know that Indiana has recently passed a bill called SB 101. Now, this, quote, religious freedom bill, which was passed recently, I think on the 24th, would effectively allow for the legal protection of business owners who wish to refuse service to same-sex couples. Now, this bill, of course, is under the guise of, well, I don't want to provide my services to somebody who is in a gay relationship because I'm a Christian or I'm a Buddhist or I'm insert any bigoted, offensive religious term. And now you have legal right to segregate your customers, to deny service, and to infringe on civil liberties. It's an offensive and draconian ruling. And you would think that surely there is no way that such a ruling could ever make it into the legal books, but yet it has. Indiana's Republican Governor Mike Pence was quite proudly willing to sign that bill. And of course, this has quite justly upset a lot of people. I mean, this is institutionalized discrimination, obviously. So Gen Con has made a stand. They released an official letter to Indiana Governor Mike Pence regarding diversity and SB 101. The letter was issued by Gen Con's CEO and owner, Adrian Stwartout. And some interesting quotes from it. Last year, Gen Con hosted more than 56,000 attendees from more than 40 different countries in all 50 states. Gen Con proudly welcomes a diverse attendee base made up of different ethnicities, cultures, beliefs, sexual orientations, gender identities, abilities, and socioeconomic backgrounds. We are happy to provide an environment that welcomes all, and the wide-ranging diversity of our attendees has become a key element to the success and growth of our convention. Legislation that could allow for refusal of service or discrimination against our attendees will have a direct negative impact on the state's economy. The letter also points out that Gen Con regularly creates in excess of $50 million in revenue for the city and state. It also points out that the bill, or SB 101, will impact on Gen Con's future in Indiana. To quote the article again, passage of the bill will factor into our decision-making on hosting the convention in the state of Indiana in future years. Now, keeping in mind, as I pointed out, the amount of revenue that this conference generates is nothing to sneeze at. The fact that it's been held for nearly a decade, or more than a decade, really, in Indiana is also a pretty important factor for tourism. The convention center has actually expanded itself several times in order to accommodate Gen Con. You know, that's a significant impact to the city's economy. It brings in lots of tourists. And ultimately, it's going to have a huge impact if this conference leaves the state. Now, you know, it remains to be seen exactly whether or not Gen Con will follow up on that. I'm sure that they could probably find a venue that would host them gladly, especially considering the money that they'll bring into the situation. But, you know, will they actually move? Maybe they have a lease. Maybe there's an agreement. All that remains to be seen. But it's important that big organizations like this do stand up and make a point of saying that if your state has a bunch of discriminatory, bigoted laws, we're probably not going to come there. And ultimately, this is great because it's targeting them where, you know, these politicians generally only seem to care about, and that is the economy. So I think a good moral stand on Gen Con, good for them. for standing up for civil rights and civil liberties. We'll see where this goes. We'll have to follow up and find out, you know, do they follow through with their threat? And not that I'm wishing them to move, but I hope they do, because obviously this sort of thing needs to be backed up. And clearly, the Republican Mike Pence is not going to back down. He's more than happy to discriminate against people who don't, you know, share his worldview. So hopefully there'll be consequences for this. And we'll see Gen Con move to a more diverse and welcoming area, perhaps Vancouver. Well, let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here.
God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down. Climbed up.
Ugh. Isn't there
anything?
Anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people, so check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Shut up! Shut up and listen to me right now. This is Fred Schneider and you're listening to CITR. Shut up and listen to this radio station.
Welcome back to The Sector, discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, and activism, right here on CITR. With me, your host, Ethan Clow. Now, so the discussion at the start of the show was damn politics, those damn politicians and their politicalness. Here in Canada, we've had a number of pretty controversial political elements playing out. I mean, well, a lot, really. There's too many to pick from. So I've decided to focus in on two elements that have caught my eye, and I wanted to provide a bit more context here on the show. Now, as always, I invite your feedback, and I'd love to hear from you and what you think about these issues, what you think about these topics. Please share your thoughts with me. You can email at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, you can tweet us. We are on Twitter. I'm at Twitter at Ethan Clow, as well as at Sector Podcast. And of course, visit us on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And you can download the podcast itself and see all of our show notes at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. You can also do that at citr.ca, where you can subscribe to the podcast. And of course, as a reminder, soon CITR will have a new webpage, which will streamline the whole subscribing to podcast process. And that'll be a lot more intuitive than it is right now. So hopefully we can all look forward to that. As I mentioned at the top of the show, The CPC has recently reported on the Conservative government's income-splitting tax incentives. These tax incentives are designed to help out BC families, particularly those on the lower income side. But it turns out, and perhaps not surprisingly, that these tax incentives, in fact, almost exclusively don't help people in the lower income bracket. Instead, they seem to focus mostly on helping people in the middle to high income bracket. Now, this whole scheme is meant to fulfill the Conservatives' 2011 election promise to bring income splitting for families. Now, the reality, of course, is that as this benefits about 15% of the Canadian household total, it generally goes to middle and middle high income households. Now, obviously, opposition has been pointing out the fact that this is not helping lower income families at all. And even the late Jim Flaherty, who was the in charge of the finance portfolio, even denounced his own party's plan on this, saying that, quote, that it benefits some parts of the Canadian population a lot and other parts of the Canadian population virtually not at all. Since that time, the government has modified the original promise, but it's not exactly all that helpful. The YWCA has added to the criticism around the program, stating that it virtually excludes single-parent families. Quote, I think it's a moral failure of our society, said Janet Austin, the CEO of Metro Vancouver YWCA. The, in British Columbia, for instance, there are approximately 16,000 single-parent families on income and disability assistance. This is a reflection of the poverty of women and the fact that we don't recognize the importance of the care of children and recognize that it is our economic value, to quote Austin again. It's worth noting, though, that the Conservatives did actually revise the plan since it was announced, when a lot of these criticisms came to light. But even with these tweaks, the critics say that it's only going to benefit about 15% of Canadian families. And in fact, independent analysis has said that the biggest tax savings are going to go to families with incomes of more than $233,000 a year. Obviously, that's pretty extreme, considering that we have a lot of single-parent families who are making nowhere near that. And again, I think it goes into this moral question of on high moral rationalization. This notion that a single-parent family is inherently worse than a two-parent family, and specifically a two-parent family made up of a man and a woman. A female single parent, more likely than not in Canada, is going to be on the extreme low end of income income earning in Canada, and ultimately does not benefit that much from this policy. So not only is this a question of it benefiting people who are already well off, but it's ignoring the people who are worse off and ignoring them in a way that kind of implies both a moral judgment as well as a sort of social judgment by the political Conservative Party. Now, this isn't the only instance of the Harper Conservatives morally legislating from on high. Recently in the House of Commons, the Bill C-2, the Respect for Communities Act, was passed. Now, this bill, which unfortunately is, you know, pleasantly named, but ultimately fulfills a very cruel objective. The bill is designed to effectively block the establishment of new supervised injection facilities like Vancouver's Insight. The bill could make it much harder for places like Insight to stay open, and it effectively prevents a similar health service from opening in any other Canadian city. Now, listeners may know that I believe Ottawa and Montreal have both been in considerations for a safe injection site, as well as this harm reduction strategy has been employed all over the world with great success, actually, places like Amsterdam, Portugal, and others have all been looking at this model and adapting it for their own jurisdictions. So you have the Harper government saying, well, we tried to shut down Insight, that failed. They went through the Supreme Court, that failed. Now they're placing legislation to block this healthcare service from establishing itself elsewhere in the country. And you have to ask yourself, when have you ever heard of a government actually going out of its way to block healthcare services in any part of the country? I mean, it's remarkably insane. It's obscene, really, when you think about it. I mean, consider, for example, a medical treatment. Let's say that chemotherapy. Let's say that for whatever reason, a politician opposes it, maybe for religious reasons, maybe for some other reason. So instead of simply taking the fact that there are certain medical treatments that are proven, that are effective, that are safe, and that are required, they decide to craft legislation to ban it. And maybe they can't shut down any hospitals that are actually using this treatment, but they can make it so that other hospitals can't be established that use this treatment. We're talking about removing a life-saving medical treatment that indeed is constitutionally protected here in Canada. You can't take away healthcare from somebody. But that's exactly what's happening here. The Conservative government has made a decision that the only way to treat drug addiction is their way, which is this kind of zero tolerance, abstinence only method that has been proven not to work time and time again. And anything that deviates from this strategy is considered not just incorrect, but I mean, it's considered incorrect in spite of evidence. They're relying more on an ideological argument instead of an actual fact-based argument. It would be as though if you were having a debate over something like seatbelts, and you came to the table and said, now look, Ethan, here's a whole bunch of evidence that seatbelts save lives. You know, here are the statistics, here are the records, here's the data. And I said, well, maybe, but seatbelts are also worn by Nazis. And since Nazis are bad people, we shouldn't have seatbelts. What? What doesn't make any sense? What are you talking about? If you look at the evidence, you see that there is a direct correlation between wearing a seatbelt and not dying. But if you reject, you know, rational, logical argument and substitute it with ideological rhetoric, you can make the case for anything. And the fact that the Conservative government has basically been doing that for the past, you know, 5-10 years, and not just the Conservative government, I mean, this is a trend in politics, as I said, damn politics. But I mean, if you think about this from the point of view of relying on rhetoric or ideology to establish legislation, is so, it's from a different mental universe. If we want to establish a society that is based on progress, and not just in the question of progress as in from moving from point A to point B, but if we actually want to solve medical controversies, if we want to actually make healthcare work and move on from the problems that we're having, we can't rely on a traditional way of thinking in which certain options are just removed from the table because there is a history of ideological resistance. If we continue to make decisions that way, we're not going to solve any problems. And yet that's exactly what's happening here. And let's remember that in 2011, when the Supreme Court of Canada decided in their case, Canada versus the Portland Hotel Society and Community Services Society, they decided that the evidence brought forth by the Conservative government that Insight was not working or not effective or not safe, or that it violated the criminal code and it undermined Canadian law and civil society, they all decided that when they looked at that argument and then looked at the evidence that was being presented by Insight, by the Portland Hotel Society, and, you know, by Insight's defenders, they saw that there was a discrepancy between a moral argument being made by the conservatives and a factual science-based argument being made by Insight, and they ruled in Insight's favor. The court went as far as to say that the decision to shut it down would violate drug users' constitutional rights, not just for life and security of person, but that, quote, whereas here the evidence indicates that a supervised injection site will decrease the risk of death and disease, and there is little or no evidence that it will have a negative impact on public safety. You know, that's a very damning result when you take a look at this notion of, again, making a moral judgment and then trying to legislate that moral judgment on the rest of the country. With Bill C-2 passing, the government has basically imposed a series of extreme requirements that any new supervised injection site would have to meet. You know, and again, it's not so much that it's banning them outright, it's that it's imposing all these restrictions to make it almost impossible for a supervised injection site to be created. Again, going back to the fact that the Supreme Court of Canada ordered the Harper government to stop interfering with the running of Insight and this healthcare process. Under Bill C-2, facilities that want to run a supervised injection site must have a lengthy list of requirements met, including a letter from the head of the local police force, statistics and other information on crime, public nuisance, and inappropriately discarded drug paraphernalia in the vicinity of the site, a report on consultations with, quote, a broad range of community groups. There'll be background checks for all those required to be in charge of the facility, along with key staff members. Quite a laundry list of things. And those requirements are only the tip of the iceberg. I mean, looking through the actual bill, there are dozens of requirements here. Everything from having a financial plan that demonstrates the feasibility and sustainability of the operating site, letters from innumerable members of the community, police chiefs, government officials, doctors, medical care providers, descriptions of drug treatment services available, relevant information including trends on loitering in a public place that may be related to certain activities involving illicit substances, on trafficking controlled substances, and on minor offense rates in the vicinity of the site, information on any public health emergency in the vicinity of the site or in the municipality in which the site would be located that may be in relation to activities involving illicit substances as declared by a competent authority with respect to public health. I mean, they're asking for documentation and material that is not typically provided under normal healthcare procedures for this type of facility. You know, it would be, imagine if an organization wanted to build a new hospital in a location and the government wanted to know every little nitpicking detail about its location. Which direction is it facing? What are the financial realities of this location? How many people live there? All of these factors, you know, that go into the planning phase are not necessarily the responsibility of the medical professionals who are running the facility. That's a long-term process that is generally handled collaboratively with the municipality and the city and the government and other forces. This is just kind of being tossed rather unfairly at the feet of the people who are organizing the safe injection site. I mean, again, because it's not like these stats and these questions are irrelevant, but that the question of solving this problem normally would not be put at the feet of the people running the safe injection site. It would be a collaborative problem-solving process that would be managed by a whole team of individuals and organizations. Looking at some of the reaction that this bill has provoked, the Canadian Nurses Association says that it is, quote, disappointed that the bill was passed in the House and, quote, concerned by the Conservative government's tough-on-crime position. quote, a government truly committed to public health and safety would enhance access to prevention and treatment services instead of building more barriers. Now, the association represents 135,000 registered nurses issued this statement. And again, I think that it goes to show you that if major healthcare professionals are saying this is abnormal and this is not helping the situation, it's making it harder to provide medical care and services to people, then we have a serious problem with recognizing the humanity of some of the most vulnerable people in Canada. The Conservative government seems to be thinking that anyone who uses drugs or takes drugs or is battling addiction is somehow a criminal threat to the country, and that any process that helps them, which does not reinforce the notion that what they are doing is wrong and they're evil and they're weak and they're bad, can't be allowed. And this is a really sort of knee-jerk, you know, old-school reaction to a public health menace. Additionally, a statement to parliamentarians opposing the bill includes the names of about 120 signatories, including the Canadian AIDS Society, Vancouver Coastal Health, the Toronto Public Health. Federal Health Minister Rona Ambrose has been clear in her opposition to harm reduction measures, saying she instead favors harm elimination. And again, which is a fancy way of saying, I want to criminalize people who are suffering from addictions. This is nonsense. This is 18th century thinking, where we vilified people for having diseases, where we made moral judgments about somebody because they weren't well. The idea here, like, is that we have this myopic viewpoint that drug use and addiction only happens to people who have or lack kind of a moral framework, which we know is not true. I mean, just as another example, if we look at veterans who come back from war, many of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Many of them fall into addiction habits. Is that because they lack moral fiber? Is that because they were raised incorrectly? Do they have some terrible character flaw? Well, obviously not. These people are willing to put their lives at risk to help other people. Surely that is an indication of a strong character right there. Now, and yet we don't see the same kind of moralizing, paternalistic language coming down on veterans the way that we see it coming down on people dealing with addictions or people who are living, you know, for example, in Vancouver's downtown east side. The question, of course, becomes, where is notions of compassion in our lawmaking process? If we're going to moralize, if we're going to rule based not on science or facts or reality, but rule based on emotion and a asinine desire to meet up with these antiquated views of health and what a outstanding citizen of Canada would look like in terms of their health, then ultimately we have to ask ourselves, where do we find compassion in that? Because traditionally, when we make moral judgments about health and welfare, it's not based on compassion. You know, we make generalizations based on, oh, that person's an alcoholic, or that person's a crack addict, or, you know, that person is overweight and obese. Clearly they have no self-control. Clearly they just eat whatever they want. Oh, you know, look at that person, they have cancer. Well, I guess, you know, they spoke too much, or they, you know, sucked on the back of a car's exhaust vent. You know, like, this notion of, if we're going to rule things based on emotion, then what is the primary emotion that motivates us to make these judgments? Because it certainly isn't compassion. It's certainly not a sense of altruism. And I think that one of the other aspects about this, which the Conservative government is really upplaying, is this notion of NIMBYism, you know, the not in my backyard mentality, and they're trying to mobilize the conservative base around this notion. I mean, I've had many conversations with conservative family members and people who, for, you know, lack of any other better way to describe them, have foolishly voted conservative in the past. Whenever we discuss something like this, they always bring up the question, well, oh, sure, you think it's great, but would you like it in your backyard? Well, you know, first of all, it's such a nonsense argument in the first place. I mean, if we unpack it a little bit and think about it. First of all, I don't live in an area where InSight would be effective. You know, like the idea of building a safe injection site where drug addicts don't go is not helpful. You know, I mean, in the same way that if you wanted to build a fire department, you know, building a fire department in the middle of the desert, it's not a great location, not a great venue for that fire department. In much the same way. So again, like, it's not a question that I'm ever going to have to deal with because I live in a place where it's a, you know, residential zone. It's not going to have a lot of drug addicts in it. Even if it did, though, here's the thing. Even if I did live in an area close to the downtown east side, I would want InSight around. Not only is InSight a place where you're actually helping the community by establishing it, you're removing potential dangers from the streets. You're less likely to find things like ewes and needles laying around InSight. You're less likely to have people who are taking drugs in back alleys and behind dumpsters where it's not safe, where it's not clean, where that's going to attract crime and violence. Instead, you're having people use drugs with medical supervision, with healthcare professionals standing by in case they go into an overdose or cardiac arrest or something. So they're not out there suffering in the elements. They're not out there in a place where, as a normal, ordinary guy, I'm going to run into them and have to deal with them. Not that dealing with somebody like an addict is this horrendous, life-changing experience. Again, that sense of that notion that there's like this otherness about these people that makes them like aliens. We know that's not the case. They're just regular people who have an addiction and they need help. They don't need to be marginalized and pushed away. And that's another way that the whole not in my backyard argument breaks down, because if people are using drugs in your neighborhood, they're not just going to stop. They're going to keep using drugs. So would you rather have them use drugs in your backyard as it is, or would you rather have a facility in your backyard that can help them deal with their addiction, do so in a safe way, and limits the exposure of things that you don't like dirty used needles in your backyard? It's always the argument that by building a place like InSight, you're going to attract drug users, that you're going to bring them into your neighborhood. Whereas that really misses the whole point, because you build these facilities where the drug addicts are, where drug addiction is having a major impact on society. They go where the need is. They don't build it somewhere and then attract people to it. That's just silly. Which is, again, why this whole not in my backyard thing just breaks down when you really think about it. If you work or live in the downtown east side and you see the drug addiction around you and the harm that it's causing, you want a facility like InSight in your backyard to help make things better. If you live in a nice posh area and there's no problem with drug use, and so you think, well, I don't want InSight here because it's going to bring drug use, InSight would never go there. They never put it there because there's no need for it there. It has to go where there is a need, where people are suffering, to make things better. Which is, I think, the horrible irony about the whole not in my backyard thing is that, in reality, if InSight is needed, you want it in your backyard. I mean, again, it's part of this whole notion of creating a moral question around a health concern and then providing a judgment on it by the conservative government. You know, the notion of drug addicts have made a moral failing, which allowed them to become drug addicts. To treat them in a way that does not criminalize or morally judge them is to tacitly say, we approve of your lifestyle. But again, you would never have a doctor come into the hospital and say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to treat cancer patients because I don't approve of a cancer patient's lifestyle. Sorry, that doesn't happen. You don't get to do that. You don't get to moralize over somebody's health crisis. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We will return after this.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And we're back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow. Well, we are running out of time here on today's show, so this has been episode 39, Damn Politics. And indeed, I do encourage you all to don't take this damn politics laying down. We have opportunities in this country to voice our displeasure, and I encourage you to do so. I was actually just following some tweets by various civil liberties proponents talking specifically about Bill C-2. By raising more awareness about this, by focusing in on what this bill is doing and the sort of cruel nature of revoking health care from individuals in Canada, that resonates with people. So please keep voicing your displeasure about this. There is an election coming up this year, and it's important that as many Canadians as possible hear about these things, the effects that they're having, and how they are flagrantly going against the evidence, the facts, the realities of healthcare and social services. The more people who hear about this, the more outrage and the more likely they will be to stand up and say, you know what, I don't want to live in a Canada that treats people like this. You could also reach out and look into your political representatives, both senators and parliamentarians in the House of Commons. Figure out who has been supporting these bills and make sure that they're aware that you know that they do not represent your values. And likewise, look into the politicians, both elected and not, and see where the different parties align on this. I know that the NDP have been more strongly in favor of harm reduction in the past. In fact, I believe that a few Liberal MPs even voted with the government on this one. So make sure that they are aware of the fact that they are not representing your values as well. It's really important that we let our politicians know that they can't just make these sweeping broad changes and expect us to forget about them the next time election rolls around. It's really important for us to stay politically active. And simply tweeting about it, posting it on Facebook, you know, sure, it may seem like it's slacktivism or you may feel like you're not having a big impact, but spread the word around and talk to your friends about it. That can create a lot of social movement. And hopefully, if we raise enough awareness about this, the newspapers will still talk about it. The CBC and other news organizations will continue to talk about it, and it will stay front and center. And there'll be a chance to undo this damage, you know, next time we elect a real government. Well, I mean, that's my political public service statement for this week on episode 39 of The Sector. Of course, tune in next week when we'll be back. Hopefully, my voice will be fully recovered and I won't sound like I'm speaking through a sock full of marbles, but you never know. So maybe this is my new voice. We'll have to live with it. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, my thanks to all of you for tuning in and listening. I really appreciate it. We will see you all next week, next Friday, 8 a.m. here on The Sector, live at cihear.ca, and of course via podcast whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Goodbye, folks. See you next week.